Well, it is great to be back. We are just delighted to be able to share this time again with you, and glad to see especially Harvey and Marion back from their long sojourn out west. It's good to have our class mom tending to affairs again. I was just in England and met so many wonderful, warm British people, and Marion is certainly a good representative of her country here among us. I was on a trip this last week, 1 week debating and speaking tour to Germany and England that I'd like to share a little bit with you about, because it was really quite a remarkable event. It was sponsored by the European Apologetics Network, which is a group that has been hosting for the last 3 years apologetics conferences in Hungary and inviting young, promising Christian apologists from all over Europe, about 25 different countries, to come to Hungary to receive training in apologetics during this summer conference. And one of the visions that they got in the course of that conference was to have a sort of debating and speaking tour that I would do at various European universities to provide a kind of evangelistic, apologetic outreach that they could put on in their own country. And so this was the first year that we've tried to do this. And the two countries that stepped forward and said, we're ready to host an event, were Germany and Great Britain. And so I flew over last Saturday to London, spent a night there to kind of recover from the jet lag a little bit, and then the next morning flew on to Munich. And for the next 5 days, every day I would fly in the morning or travel in the morning and then debate in the evening and sleep in the afternoon. So it was very, very hectic and rigorous schedule. The first debate was at the Technical University in Munich and was hosted by a young Christian philosopher and theologian there named Daniel von Wachter. And my opponent was a German philosopher named Norbert Hörster. And this was in German. I did my doctorate at the University of Munich, so it was kind of coming home there, but my German's rather rusty. So I really rehearsed and practiced a lot for this and hoped that I could listen to his German as he spoke very rapidly enough to be able to understand what he was saying and then offer response. And when I arrived there, Daniel had booked a huge hall, a great lecture hall, and I thought, well, this really shows vision on his part. But he said to me, I don't have any idea how many people are going to come to this. And as I gathered with, he introduced me to a couple of Christian students and a couple of Christian profs, and they said, well, let's go pray before the event begins. And we went into this empty room and prayed, and one of the Christian professors prayed like this. He said, oh, Lord, please send people to this debate this evening so that the hall will not be almost empty. And I thought, whoa, you know, ye a little faith. But that's sort of what you have to, in a way, lower your expectations when you're in Europe. Before I left, Jan said to me, now you've got to remember what Europe is like. If 25 or 30 people show up, you can't be discouraged. You've got to just understand it's much more secular there, and you just minister to those that come. And so I was trying to keep those expectations in view. Well, went into the room, they introduced me to Norbert Hörster, and we both sat down and spread out our materials, and people then began slowly filing into the auditorium, you know, and they kept coming in. Pretty soon it was half full, and I thought, whoa, this is great. They still kept coming in, coming in. Finally, Daniel von Wachter got up to the front and he said, please, everybody scoot to the middle so that people sitting in the aisles will have some place to sit. So everybody moved in, and then people filled up those side seats. And in the end, virtually every seat in the auditorium was taken. There were only a couple down in the front row on the end that weren't taken. Almost every seat was filled. So the German Christian students and faculty who were involved in putting this on were just elated. They were just so excited to see that this many people would come to this event. And it was interesting when they introduced us, because I hold doctorates in philosophy and theology from the University of Birmingham in England and the University of Munich in Germany. What I didn't realize when they introduced Hörster was that he also has two earned doctorates. And I thought, wow, there's, you know, four earned doctorates between the two debaters here tonight. But then they introduced Daniel von Wachter, who is the moderator, and it turns out Daniel has doctorates that he earned at Oxford University and the University of Munich. So the three participants in the debate that night represented six earned doctoral degrees. And I thought, man, only in Germany do you have that kind of academic firepower on display. It was really unusual. Well, the debate was on the existence of God, and having read Hoester's material in advance, I figured he would bring up the problem of evil, and so I prepared a very thorough response to that, and sure enough, that's exactly what he brought up. And I just went through the logic of the problem, the same logic I've explained in this class when we went through this, showing how there's no logical contradiction, and how the attempt to defend hidden premises that would bring out the contradiction is unsuccessful, and then actually showing how you can show that God and evil are logically consistent. And poor Professor Hoester just hadn't heard any of this. What he was not familiar with the current cutting-edge work in Anglo-American philosophy of religion. And that's the huge difference, I think, between Europe and the U.S. Over there, philosophy of religion is utterly undeveloped. There aren't really very many, if any, Christian philosophers. And so what passes for good work in this area is really superficial, popularistic arguments that might move lay people, but really you couldn't publish it in an Anglo-American philosophy journal or professional theology journal. And so he just wasn't really in a position to defend his argument anymore. And then we went to Q&A and had a really good time interacting with the German students. And the last question was something about religious experience and how does this affect you personally. And so I was able to close out the evening by telling my story of Christ, how he had entered my life as a 16-year-old, and many of you have heard that before. And that just really seemed to connect emotionally with the students in the audience. One afterwards came up to me and said, the best thing you shared all night was your testimony at the end. So don't underestimate, I want to say to you, the power of sharing your testimony, because I go into these debates and share the arguments, but again and again, it's the personal testimony that seems to really connect with people. So that debate just went very well, and everyone was just really excited about the result of that. Well, the next night then I flew, or the next morning I flew up to Düsseldorf for a debate that evening at Heinrich Heine Universität. Now, this debate, unfortunately, was almost the exact opposite of what happened in Munich. In this debate, they had booked a huge hall, and only about 25, 30, 40 people showed up. So the attendance was quite disappointing. And the opponent in this debate, his name was Dr. Schmidt Salomon, and he is the head of a kind of free thought society in Germany called the Giordano Bruno Foundation. Bruno was a guy that was burned at the stake, you know, for heresy, and so they founded a foundation in his honor to promote free thought and things like this. And this fellow, again, he was not a sophisticated philosopher in terms of grasping the issues. But what he would do is he would get up and denounce religion for all the persecution and the Crusades, and he denounced Christianity for all the evil in the world. You know, these things that resonate with your typical secular German student who hates Christianity because of all the evil and persecution and so forth that's done in the world. And then he would say things about my arguments that were just completely false. He would say that they were logically fallacious, that they weren't formulated correctly, and that I failed to make these distinctions. But the problem was, he said this all in his second speech, so I didn't have a chance to respond to it, because the way they had the format was, there was a first speech from each, and then a second speech from each, and then immediately to Q&A. And so I had no opportunity to respond to all these false allegations. So it was very frustrating to me. And during the Q&A time, these students, instead of asking questions about the arguments, they would ask questions about kind of the hobby horses that they were riding when they came in that night. You know the typical questions. How can you say a loving God can send people to hell? Or what about all the hypocrites in the church? It was that they didn't even need to have heard the debate in order to ask these kind of questions. And so finally I said, you know, the objections that Dr. Schmidt Zalamun has offered in my arguments are all fallacious. I can answer all of them easily, but I need the opportunity. Will someone please ask me a question about one of these arguments? And still, nobody asked any question about those things. So I was just very frustrated. Afterwards, the fellow who put it on, he was an American missionary named Daniel Göring, a German name, but he's an American. He said, you know, these German students just aren't trained to think about these things. So he said, probably for many of them, they just didn't even know how to ask a question. They did not even think of a question. And I think the hostile ones in the audience didn't want to hear the answer, frankly, to his objections. So I came away from that debate feeling very frustrated and spent a very fitful night's sleep that night. As you can imagine, it wasn't just the jet lag, but these arguments and his responses kept going over and over in my mind again, you know, and I just found it really difficult to sleep. What I did finally say in the debate that I hope will be somewhat helpful is that my actual responses to his arguments and his to mine are longer than what we could actually present in the oral debate because we only had like 10 minutes for a response. And so we're going to be posting these longer texts in German on a website in Germany where people can go to them and read them. And so I encourage the students that when they do this, they should take his speech and my speech and put them side by side. And I said, if you do this and look at them carefully, I think you'll see that in every case, his responses don't even mesh with my arguments. They don't respond to them at all. So I'm hoping that at least this written transcript will reach far more people than the actual debate did. I mean, only 30 or so people actually heard the debate. And I think that when you look at these arguments and the debate in what's called a cool medium, namely a print medium, rather than in a hot medium of an oral live presentation, that it will be much more clear, I think, where the truth lies in these arguments. So I do think that's one good thing that came out of that debate in the end. But it was very frustrating for me. Well, I knew I couldn't spend time thinking about the past. I had a debate the next day. I had to go on to Oxford. So I just tried to focus on the future, and I flew off the next morning to England, where my contact there, Roger Priest, met me at Heathrow Airport and picked me up and drove me to Oxford. Now, Roger is a terrific fellow. He is a former businessman who worked in the financial district in London and fairly high roller kind of guy in London financial circles. But he's a devoted Christian, and he felt that God was calling him into the Anglican ministry as an Anglican minister. And so he's left his business, sold their house, moved to Oxford, and he's now enrolled in St. Stephen's Hall, which is a college, an Anglican college, part of the University of Oxford, where he's taking orders in the Anglican church. And Roger took a real interest in trying to use his business entrepreneurial skills to put together the events in Oxford. And you could really see those professional skills coming out in the events that he organized at that university. He didn't want to have the events at Oxford be Christian events, Christian-sponsored events. He wanted them to be events that were officially hosted by the university. And so that was his goal, was to work through the ropes, pull the strings necessary to get the university to sponsor me in these various events. And so the first thing that he was able to do through contacts with a Christian professor was get me into a class at Oxford University, a seminar that was taught by Professor John Hedley Brooke. Now, Brooke is a very famous historian of science who does work on Isaac Newton, and whose work I quoted in my own work on God and time when I was looking at Newton's views on God and time. And so I knew Brooke's work, and the idea of speaking in this man's seminar was just a thrill if that could come about. Well, it turns out that Brooke also knew my work. And he was very impressed, I guess, with it, because he was just effusive in saying, oh, we're so thrilled to have Dr. Craig come and speak in our class, and on and on and on like this. And so it was just an open door for me to speak in this seminar. And to I spoke to the students on God and time and the special theory of relativity. And I don't think they were expecting a Christian speaker from Talbot School of Theology, you know, to deal with these things on this kind of a sophisticated scientific level. And so that seminar went very good, and Professor Brooke was just, he was just, well, really over the top in his enthusiasm and thankfulness for my coming. So I think that was a strategic kind of meeting in terms of opening the academic door at Oxford University for what they want to do in the future with me. If I should come back there for more outreaches. There's now some academic credibility established in the faculty with a key figure. And so that was very good. Well, that was Wednesday afternoon. Then I went Wednesday night to the Theology Society at Oxford University to give a speech to them. Now, this Theology Society is not a Christian group. It is an official organ of the university. But it's very interesting. There are lots of American evangelicals studying in Oxford. I was just amazed at the number of American evangelical students that I was introduced to there. And these American evangelical students have more or less taken over the leadership of this theological society. All of the leaders in this society were American evangelical Christians, except one Russian girl who was also an evangelical who had come to Christ, and she was on the committee with these Americans. So no Brits at all. And one of them was a graduate of Biola University who was a good friend of Charity, our daughter. And so that was just an immediate contact. And they set up an evening meeting for me to speak on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And they booked as big a room as they could get for this. Now, Roger warned me in advance that the Theological Society usually only has 20 people come to their meetings. And he says, therefore, he says, if you get 30 people, you are not allowed to be disappointed in the attendance. He says, 30 people, you've got to be pleased with that. And I said, all right, I won't complain. I won't be disappointed if we get 30 people. Well, that night when we walked into the room, it was wall-to-wall people. I mean, you could hardly even turn around. They must have squeezed over 300 people into this little room. They were sitting on the floor in front of the stage. They were sitting on the stage, you know, around us. They were out the door listening in the hall. And then a lot of people just had to be turned away. And what they did to make the meeting more interesting was they had an Oxford New Testament professor respond briefly to my paper. And his name was Muddyman. He didn't muddy the waters, though maybe that was sort of a fit with his name. But Muddyman was kind of, he wasn't a radical liberal, you know, not a raving liberal. He was just a little bit kind of off to the left, you know. So it made it a very interesting evening because it wasn't real confrontational, you know, with a real skeptic. But it was very collegial, and he disagreed with me on certain points. And then I was invited to give my response to him, and I got up then and showed why I thought he was mistaken and where, in fact, the points I made were good points. And it was fun. It was humorous. It was lighthearted. He said at one point in response to my argument that the resurrection of Jesus is necessary in order to explain the origin of the Christian faith, he said, well, I don't think you should put all your eggs in one basket. I responded to that, well, I do think there are, of course, other factors in the claims of Christ and his life, but really it's the resurrection that is key. And as for putting all my eggs in one basket, well, at least they're Easter eggs. And he even had a good laugh at that. So it was a very collegial time, very nice. And then they threw it open to the students for questions. And unlike the students, say, in Dusseldorf, these students at Oxford posed questions directly on what was said, you know, on the lecture that was given and the response to it. And they were very analytical, direct, really good questions. And they not only challenged me, some of them, but some of them challenged Muddyman as well on what he was saying. There were a couple of girls in the audience that really held his feet to the fire. And I was very proud of them because I thought, I'm not going to say anything, and I'm just going to sit here and let these girls take this guy on, you know? And so, again, they were just thrilled with the response and with how the evening went. I mean, just the warmth and the credibility of the defense of the resurrection. Afterwards, Roger said to me, what made this talk so different, he said, is that these Oxford students, when they hear someone, a professor, talk about the resurrection, what it's like is he'll get up and he'll go through the form critical analysis of the narratives, giving both sides of the discussion. Here are the objections, here are the arguments, and back and forth. And never really take a position on it himself. And then you just kind of quit, and that's the end. And nobody knows what to believe. He said what was so different was that here was a professor who was willing to get up and say, this is what I think, and here are the reasons why, and then give a convincing case for it. And I guess they just found that very different and very refreshing. And so afterwards, there was just thunderous applause after the event was over, and I think it was a tremendous encouragement to the Christians, as well as a challenge to the non-believers that were there. So that left me feeling very encouraged and very good about both of the events that occurred Wednesday. Well, the next day, Roger and I got up early and drove over to Cambridge, England, for my debate at Cambridge University. And this was sponsored by a group called Christian Heritage, which is a private Christian foundation, who was putting on the debate. So this was not an official function of Cambridge University. Cambridge seems to be much more closed than Oxford. I think there are many more Christians at Oxford than at Cambridge. And so the best that could be done in Oxford was for this Christian group to rent a hall at the university. So it wasn't a university building, but it was put on by Christian Heritage. And the two fellows that are involved in that were Ian Cooper and then Ronald McCauley, who is the son-in-law of Francis Schaeffer. And both of these men helped to found Labrie in England, and really dear, good Christian brothers. And my opponent for this debate was a fellow named Arif Ahmed. And I don't know if Arif Ahmed was ever himself a Muslim. His name is certainly Islamic, and he was ethnically Islamic, but he seemed to be thoroughly Anglicized. He was very young, some probably in his 20s, just gotten his doctorate, so a young philosopher at Cambridge University, and may well have never been a Muslim. Maybe his parents were, maybe he was just an atheist. But that was the position he espoused, was atheism. And this fellow, again, his arguments weren't that good, but he was very skilled rhetorically. He had objections for all of my arguments for God. He had three arguments of his own for atheism, and he would use all kinds of very good debating techniques like organizing his time, trying to put me on the defensive, and just other sorts of techniques. He was a very good debater. So whatever he lacked in philosophical ability, he made up in his debating ability. And again, the thing that left me frustrated in this debate was the format. We had two opening speeches, two responses, and then went immediately to Q&A. So again, I couldn't respond to his final response. And he was very, very condescending and disrespectful in this debate, trying to paint me as, you know, sort of a dumb American fundamentalist, I think, frankly. He would say things like this, with respect to my argument concerning the impossibility of an actually infinite number of things, he would just respond to this by saying, well, Dr. Craig is not trained in mathematics. And then in other arguments, he would say, well, Dr. Craig, those arguments may work at Talbot School of Theology, but they won't fly at Cambridge University. And on another occasion, he said, in response to the argument against an infinite regress, he said, every event is followed by another event. Now, which of those five words don't you understand, Dr. Craig? So it was just really, you know, annoying to be debating this guy. And I didn't return tit for tat. I was very gracious, but it was very difficult. And so during the Q&A time, before that, I had talked to Jan about my experience in Dusseldorf and my frustration there. And I said, these other debates are the same format. What am I going to do? And she said, you've got to do what the politicians do when they're asked a question. you answer the question that you want to see addressed and just ignore, you know, the question the audience is raising. And I thought, well, that's what I'm going to do. So after Ahmed had finished his second response, I felt emotionally as though I were kind of behind in the debate and had to get back into it. So during the question and answer time, I would just very briefly answer the student's question, but then use the rest of my time to say, now I want to get back to this issue that Dr. Ahmed raised. You know, every event is followed by another event, and then I would refute that. And just time and again, I would come back in this way to the things that were said, and just felt as though I was sort of clawing my way slowly back into the debate again, and then was able to finish in my final speech again by sharing my testimony of how Christ had changed my life and how he could change their lives as well. And I think that really ended with a punch and with on a good note. And so although it was a very difficult debate, both in terms of the condescension that I felt, as well as just feeling this sense of needing to claw back into it, I think it ended on a very positive note. Oh, and we had a huge crowd come out for that debate too, comparable to what we had in Munich. So that was very encouraging. And I want to take this guy on again. You know, very often I get invitations here in the U.S. and they can't find an opponent. I'm going to suggest they bring him over because I want to have another crack at this fellow in the format that I prefer. Afterwards, Ronald McCauley said to me over dinner, is this the format you prefer, Bill? And I said, no, I like a format where there are four speeches on each side. And then it was like the light just went on. I thought, that's why I'm having such difficulty. Because I win these debates in the rebuttals. It's when the other guy runs out of ammunition that then I come ahead. And I thought of the Spong debate. I thought if you had cut off that Spong debate after just two speeches apiece, he would have still looked pretty good. It was in the rebuttals that he gets up and says, I don't want to debate anymore, and just started telling stories. You know, so what had happened was I felt like in these debates I'd been cut off at the knees and wasn't able to really give the full presentation. So I'm gonna suggest that we have another round with Arif in the States sometime and see how it goes then. Well, the next morning then we drove back to Oxford, and this was really the climax of the trip. What Roger had managed to secure was an official invitation from Oxford University for a debate that evening at the Oxford Union. This is the oldest and most famous debating society in England. It's where people like Gladstone and Churchill debated. Richard Nixon spoke there at the Oxford Union after the Watergate fiasco and so forth. And initially, they wouldn't have me there. They said, you know, who's he? We don't, you know, think he's important enough to have a debate at the Union. But Roger wouldn't take no for an answer, and he kept working with members of the committee, trying to kind of lobby them, win them over to his side, and they finally got someone on the committee who was sympathetic to the idea. They went back to the president and said, what if we could get a really big-name atheist to do this with Craig? Would you then be open to it? And he said, yeah, if you could get somebody that was really a big name. And so they went and got this guy named A.C. Grayling. Now, I've never even heard of A.C. Grayling, but apparently in Britain, he's very well known as a newspaper columnist and BBC radio commentator who is just vitriolic in his denunciation of Christianity. I read some of his work in advance of the debate. He's just vicious. He blames Christianity and religion in general for just virtually every evil of society down through history, and he extols the virtues of humanism and secularism. And so they wanted to get him, and they said, if we can get A.C. Grayling, will you go for the debate? And the Union said, oh, yeah, if you can get him, we'll do it. And so Roger called A.C. Grayling, and Grayling said, yes, I'd love to be in the debate. So they were able to secure the Union for the debate that evening on Friday night and then put out the word. I walked into the event that night, and I thought, boy, you know, what is this going to be like? Because after Arif Ahmed and his, you know, condescending sarcasm and so on, I thought, Grayling is going to make that debate look like a stroll in the Sunday park, you know, compared to him. And so I said to Roger, how can we handle this, that this same thing doesn't happen again? And he said, well, let's do this. He said, after the four speeches, instead of just going to Q&A, He said, let's have a dialogue time between you and Grayling, where you take, say, three questions from the floor, and then you just dialogue about it. And that way, you can force him to answer your objections and arguments, and he won't be able to wriggle off the hook. And I said, okay, let's do it that way. So, walked into the Union that night. It's this ancient building that is lined in a kind of a horseshoe pattern with wooden benches covered with leather seats, kind of made to mimic the pattern of the seating in Parliament. And then there's this great large podium right at the end of the horseshoe where the speaker delivers his speech. And then behind that is this ancient carved wooden table where you sit. And then there's a gallery that rings the three sides of the hall around. And around the walls of the hall are these busts of people like Gladstone and Disraeli and these other ancient or famous, you know, figures that have spoken and debated there. And then there are paintings on the walls of these other prominent members of the Oxford Union down through history. And so it was a very august sort of setting. And Roger very formally introduced the whole evening, you know, very proper and everything of that sort. And then I got up to speak, and the speech went very well. I felt the opening speech was able to connect with people because you're so close. They're right around you. So really tried to have eye contact with them. And then Grayling got up to speak. And he was an interesting looking chap. He's shorter than I am, and he has long flowing gray hair, and then wire rim, gold glasses, and then dressed very properly in a three-piece suit. And when he came in, he looked at me. I had on this yellow and blue necktie, and he said, you already win on the better necktie. And I said, well, you win on the better hair. And he said, well, then we're even, aren't we? And that was all we said, you know, before the debate. And then it, you know, began. And he got up, and to my utter astonishment, he was like a docile little lamb. He didn't attack anything about Christianity. He didn't even, the problem, the debate topic was, belief in God makes sense in light of tsunamis. Belief in God makes sense in light of tsunamis. In other words, the problem of evil, right? And I thought he would at least tell emotional, heart-wrenching stories about dying children and things to get the audience on his side. He didn't do any of that. He was the perfect gentleman. And as I listened to him, I thought, you know, I'm going to wipe this guy out. This is, he's not doing anything. And then I thought, no, don't get overconfident. Don't get overconfident. You know, he can come back in the next speech and get you, you know. So I just, you know, again, when I came my turn again, I just pressed the argument forward, explained where he hadn't answered, and in a very collegial and gentlemanly way, just continued to press him, put him on the defensive. He got up in the next speech. He was no better. He just wasn't equipped to deal with these arguments. It was very clear to me he was just basically a popularizer who just is an angry, you know, person that is good in the press and the radio, but he couldn't answer the arguments. And then we went to the dialogue time, and it was just great because by having the dialogue, he couldn't wriggle out of things. When he would say something, I would challenge him on it and say, now you haven't answered the question here. Do you believe in this or not? And it was just very clear he couldn't dialogue on these issues. He would finally just sort of, you know, retreat. And then Roger would say, well, let's move on to the next question. And then we finally had closing statements. And I thought in the closing statement, having done this kind of intellectual work, I would want to try to connect with the audience emotionally, because I think that's where most people really have a problem with evil and suffering. It's emotional. And so I hope you remember this story that I shared in class. But I basically shared with them the story of Mabel. You remember the woman who for 25 years, blind, deaf, wheelchair-bound, suffered in a nursing home, but had a vibrant faith in Christ and had, as my colleague Tom Schmidt, who visited her, said, incredible power. And that was the way I closed the evening. And even Grayling was touched by the story of Mabel. He, of course, wrote it off to the strength of the human spirit, you know, to survive all kinds of suffering. But it just really did, I think, connect with folks on an emotional level rather than just an intellectual level. So that was really a great climax to the evening. And the Christians in Oxford were so encouraged. And so I anticipate that probably this will just be a door opening for future ministry there and hopefully elsewhere. So thank you so much for your prayers. It was very rigorous, very hectic traveling and debating every day and sleeping in the afternoon. But I think well worth the time, and I'm just so grateful that you were praying for me, and I'm grateful to be back today. I wanted very much to return on Saturday so that I could be back here for Sunday morning. So that's a report of how it went. Now, I understand that, what time is it, Jay? I don't have my watch today. I forgot it. 12:13? Okay. I understand that you had a very interesting time in this class with Ben Witherington when he was here. Thanks, Jay. And so I haven't had a chance yet to hear Ben's talk on what the Left Behind series left out, I think was what he had to say. But John Herring told me that he got all kinds of emails, phone calls, letters, you know, expressing how upset people were about this and why did they allow this to happen and so forth. But John said one thing to me that made me very proud of you. He said, the people who were voicing all these complaints weren't the people in your class. They were primarily the people from other classes. And I said, I think that says a lot for the people in the class, because one of the things we've tried to emphasize in this class is to think for yourself and not just take my word for things, because I say it, I can be wrong, and that there are legitimate issues on which biblically faithful Christians can disagree. And this is one of them. Eschatology, that's the study of the last things, is one of the most controversial fields of theology. And therefore, Ben Witherington's point of view, which is that there is not some sort of a secret return of Christ, some sort of a rapture, is, I would say, probably the majority view. It's certainly a view that needs, that we need to deal with and to interact with. And it's simply naive to think that there's only one sort of view on these sort of things that biblically faithful Christians can hold to. And in talking with John about it, he said to me that JFBC does not have any position on these issues, that there is not anything in their doctrinal statement. So what Ben was saying was not in any way at odds with what this church stands for. This church doesn't have a position on these issues because it recognizes that there's a diversity of opinion among Bible-believing Christians that's quite legitimate here. And John said, on the staff here at JFBC, on the ministerial staff, there are differences of opinion, that Bryant holds one view, somebody else holds another view. There's diversity of opinion here. So this is part of, I think, doctrinal maturity as Christians, that we recognize that we should have unity in the essentials and charity on the inessentials. And God help us if we have to exclude people or reject people out of our fellowship because they don't agree with our point of view on all of the secondary issues. That would make the church very, very narrow indeed. So I was pleased at least that the folks in this class were able to handle this with critical thinking and not feeling threatened. And I'm anxious to hear the tape or the CD myself, and see what I think of his presentation. So I don't know if that pours any oil on the waters or maybe just riles him up some further, but that's all I have to say so far in response to that. Did anybody else have a comment or remark that you wanted to make?
He told us not to be too open to monitor our brains of
thought. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what that means is to be critical thinkers, is what he's saying. You don't just, your mind, having an open mind doesn't mean an empty mind into which somebody else can just pour whatever they want to and you just accept it. And that's why I say, you know, don't just believe things because I say them, even though I'm the teacher of this class. You need to weigh what I say critically against Scripture and assess it for yourself. So open-mindedness, but not uncritical. Yeah. Okay, well, in our waning moments then, what I'd like to do is to move to our new topic, and we have some outlines, I believe, to distribute. Marion, do you have? They are distributed. Okay, so As you see, we're going to move now from the doctrine of God into the doctrine of Christ. We've talked about the attributes of, and existence of God. We've talked about the persons of the Trinity. We've talked about the person and work of the Holy Spirit. And now it seems appropriate to talk about Christ in his person and work, especially because many of the questions that were raised during our discussion of the Trinity were pertinent to the doctrine of the Incarnation. And so I think it's very natural to move now from the doctrine of God into the doctrine of Christ. And this is the center, I think, of Christian theology. The center of Christian theology is not simply focused upon Jesus, trying to show Jesus, the man, is the key to authentic human existence, as many modern theologians say. Rather, Christology, which is what we're talking about here, is the doctrine of Jesus the Christ. Christology is that branch of theology which deals with the doctrine of Christ. And it states in the clearest form that Jesus is the Christ. He is true man and true God. In Latin, vere homo, vere Deus. Jesus is true man and true God. And I think this is, by the way we want to express the deity and humanity of Christ. Sometimes people will say Christ is fully man or he's fully God. And I know what they mean, but that can be misleading, because if you mean he's 100% God, well, that seems to exclude any humanity. Or if he's 100% human, then where's the room for his divinity? The idea of saying he's fully man and fully God means that he is truly God and truly man. You're not making a statement about the totality of his being. The totality of Jesus Christ is not either human or divine. It's both. Namely, he's truly man and truly God in one person. And there are two central themes to Christology that need to be addressed. Namely, the person of Christ and the work of Christ. This is all by way of introduction, by the way, if you're trying to figure out where this fits on your outline. The person of Christ asks, who is Jesus Christ? That's the central question. Who is Jesus Christ? And the work of Christ asks, what has he done? Questions about the person of Christ would include, how are we to conceive of Christ as being both God and man? How are you to make sense of his divinity and humanity? If he was truly God, then how could he be human? On the other hand, if he was truly a man, then was he not divine? How can the infinite and the finite be combined in one person? How can deity and humanity coalesce in one individual? Also, we would want to ask, with respect to the person of Christ, what is the role of the historical Jesus in relationship to the exalted Christ? Does the historical make any difference to the religious truth of the Christian faith? Or is the doctrine of Christ just about this exalted Christ figure, which is not intimately connected in any essential way with the historical Jesus that actually lived? What's the connection between the exalted Christ and the historical Jesus? Questions about the work of Christ, by contrast, would include questions like this. How did the death of Christ on the cross win our salvation? What is it about the death of Christ in first century on a Roman cross that somehow wrought the salvation of the world? How are we to understand this death? And also we would want to ask, what is the relationship between his person and work? Is there something about his person that was essentially related to the work that he did so that no one else could have done that work? Or is that work something perhaps that someone else could have done? What's the connection between this person and the work that he did? Now, there are two broad ways of addressing these questions of Christology. One would be the method that is called from above, and the other one would be from below. So we can either do Christology from above, or we can approach these questions, as it were, from below. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, from above means you begin with the deity of Christ and all that Scripture teaches about his exalted status, and then you try to figure out how he can be truly man as well, and the relationship to the historical Jesus. A good proponent of this method of approaching Christology from above would be the German theologian Karl Barth, perhaps one of the most, if not the most, influential theologian of the 20th century. To approach these questions from below would be to say you begin with the historical Jesus and his claims and his resurrection from the dead, and then you infer his deity and develop your Christology from the springboard of the historical Jesus. So on this approach from below, you're beginning with the historical Jesus and working up to the exalted Christ. From above, you begin with the divine Christ, the second person of the Trinity, and work down. And a good proponent of this Christology from below would be the gentleman I studied under at the University of Munich, Wolfhard Pannenberg. Pannenberg begins by exploring the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, from which he then infers his divinity and develops his Christology. Now, how shall we proceed in our exploration of Christology? Well, it seems to me that the easiest way to understand these two approaches is as two projects, as it were. It seems to me that theology adopts the methodology of Christology from above. Theology begins with the Word of God as authoritative and inspired, and is teaching the deity of Christ, and then working from there. Apologetics, however, works from below, in that apologetics doesn't assume the truth of the Christian faith or the Bible, but rather explores historically the person and work of Jesus, and then infers to his deity and all the rest. So I see these two approaches as really involving two quite different projects, the project of theology and the project of apologetics. And in this class, of course, we do both. But our primary interest is going to be doctrinal, so we will approach it from above, from the area of theology. But obviously, we'll be interested in apologetic questions. As we've talked about around our Easter season, the evidence for the resurrection of Christ and Ben's lecture on the Da Vinci Code and the reliability of the Gospels. So we'll have an eye out on this apologetic project, but our primary approach is going to be from above, beginning with the revelation of the Bible, taking this as true, and then exploring what it teaches about the incarnation of the second person of the Trinity. Any question about those introductory remarks? All right. Well, I think that this is a good place at which to break then. It's a natural breaking spot. And so if there isn't any further question, we'll adjourn. So any other question that anybody has? Oh, hey, Jay, you didn't announce. We've got Ken Boa next week, right?
Yes, sir.
So don't forget that. We've got a special speaker next week, Ken Boa. I was impressed to read in the bulletin this morning that he has three books with gold medallion awards. That's pretty impressive. So you'll want to be sure to be here next Sunday morning to hear Ken. And I think you'll probably find that he's far less controversial than Ben Witherington. All right, we'll see you then next week.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig.